When Richard Holbrooke was ambassador for about a year, 1993 to 1994, there was that night that the Berlin Brigade marched out of Berlin. There was a big celebration, and Berlin was reunified. That was the spark that gave Holbrooke the idea of creating an American Academy in Berlin, because he understood that in the coming decades, the relationship between Germany and the United States would change. This relationship, which has been so embedded in strategic consideration, needs now to be put on another foundation, and the foundation has to be a cultural and intellectual one.
The director of the American Academy in Berlin, Gary Smith, talking about the origins of the institution back in the early 90s, as America's almost 50-year role as a military protector of the city drew to a close. Welcome to Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin and the American Academy in Berlin. I'm Jeff Rosenberg, filling in on this edition for our regular host, R.J. McGill. Previously in this series, we've focused exclusively on the fellows at the Academy, the core of its overall program, getting to know some of them and their work in various fields. That's true of this edition as well. But this time, for just a few minutes, we're going to take one step back and learn more about the Academy itself, how it came into being, and the people and programs that make up its mission. A moment ago, the Academy's director, Gary Smith, talked about the idea for an American cultural and intellectual center as the cornerstone of a new German-American relationship. Former American Ambassador Richard Holbrooke conceived the idea and then set about to make it happen. Let's pick up the story again from Gary Smith.
So he had the idea of an American Academy, which would bring scholars and artists and writers, but also people from the business world, professionals, journalists, economists together. Richard Holbrooke had persuaded at a dinner Richard von Weizsäcker, former German president, and Henry Kissinger to become co-chairman. He had persuaded the great German banker from J.P. Morgan, Kurt Firmitz, the great journalist Joe Joffe, Gail Hodges Burt. He had persuaded John Kluge to give us our first $1 million on the basis of a telephone call. And then he found this quite extraordinary villa on the lake of the Wannsee. It was when he was ambassador, he knew about it because it had been the American Recreation Center, a hotel for non-commissioned officers. But before that, it had belonged to a great banking family, the family of Hans and Ludmilla Arnhold. Now, there's a bank which people in German industry and German historians know called Arnhold and S. Bleichröder. Bleichröder was Bismarck's Jewish banker and the subject of Fritz Stern's first great book, Golden Iron. And Hans Arnhold, his bank absorbed Bleichröder, and he lived in this villa in the 20s. And he emigrated. He moved his headquarters in a timely fashion in the 30s from Berlin to New York, where then after the end of the war, they became a very important entree for German industry. But if we step back, the Arnold family, when they lived here, their house was what then was called a salon. And so they had politicians here, they had writers, they had musicians. Piotr Gorsky, the great cellist, who at one point was playing in a Russian bar in Berlin to survive, came and played in this villa. He played duets with Casals downstairs. And it was always a philanthropically minded family with deep interest in the arts, literature, politics, everything practical. So the American Recreation Center was abandoned in 1994. But then he went back to the State Department. He did the Dayton Accords, went to the Balkans. And then when he left public service and went to a bank, in 1997 he came back to Berlin, discovered the villa, the history of the house, and then he went to New York, where the daughter of Hans and Ludmilla Arnhold, Anna Maria Kellen, lived with her husband, who ran Arnhold and S. Bleichröder, and he persuaded the family to support his idea of turning this into the American Academy in Berlin. In the meantime, the family, including Baroness Nina von Maltzahn, Mrs. Arnold's niece, and the next generations, have become our greatest benefactors and actually cover, at the moment, right now, half of our budget. what this has become is, since we don't take public money, it's become something unique in Germany, actually unique in the world, I think, but certainly unique in Germany and Europe, entirely privately funded institution at this level, which has, you know, 26 fellows a year for a semester or 2 months or a year. It has a dozen or more people come for a week to a month, people like, you know, Dennis Ross or Paul Krugman or Chuck Close, who then in their week or their month are intensely engaged in meetings and conversations several times a day. Justice Breyer came 1 year as the Lloyd Cutler Fellow. The next year, Justice Scalia came. Justice Kagan just accepted our invitation to come for a week. We make the experience optimal for the people who come here, but we want the Americans to know where they are. We want them to learn about Berlin and Germans. So they can work all day, but at night we have dinner, and we invite Berliners or other Germans. We invite President von Weizsäcker, we invite, you know, Thomas Tamman and Tacita Dean, the artists, historians or writers, the whole breadth of what makes Berlin so exciting, and Germany. And the goal is not only that they establish a kind of emotional, intellectual bond to this city. If we're successful in brokering a relationship, so not just supporting their project, but enabling something beyond the tenure of their stay here, then they'll be invited back by the Institute for Advanced Study, by a university, by the Berlin Philharmonic or a music festival, consulting group, a law faculty, a migration working group. And that's one of the things that makes the Academy such an exciting place.
This is a forum to present the best and the brightest of American thinkers and creative heads to the German public. My name is Pamela Rosenberg. I'm Dean of Programs and Fellows at the American Academy in Berlin. Before I came to the Academy, because I myself have only been here now since the beginning of September 2010, I was General Manager of the Berlin Philharmonic, and prior to that, I was General Director of the San Francisco Opera. I am responsible for helping the fellows realize what they want to do here, and the presentations that they do. Also, we have, besides the fellows who are in residence, we also have a plethora of other presentations and programs. We have distinguished visitors who will be here for 3 to 5 days, very often from the public policy sector. We also have distinguished lectureships and other presentations here at the Academy. And I'm responsible for coordinating all of that, for coming up with the ideas for a lot of the distinguished visitorships, and for helping the fellows, when they're here, network with their colleagues in Berlin. We have, over the course of the 2 semesters, from September to June, a total of about 25 fellows. So at any one time, we'll have 12 or 13 people here in residence. Some are academics. They're all humanists, the academics who come to us. They're either professors of history, literature, sociology, philosophy, political science. And besides the academic fellows that we always have at least one fiction writer, one composer, one visual artist, usually a journalist. Sometimes, in addition to the fiction writer, we will have a poet. Let me tell you how the fellows are selected. They apply, and they are chosen on the strength of the project that they are proposing to work on while they're here. There is a committee based in the U.S., mainly made up of professors from distinguished universities. There is, in addition to that, though, an extra committee to choose the composer and an extra committee to choose the visual artist.
To really achieve deep understanding of other cultures, there's nothing more important than personal relationships. The personal relationships developed here, in some way, without overstating it, transform the relationships, the dynamic between our country and those spheres. Jeff Eugenides was here for a year. That was the year he finished Middlesex. More importantly, that was the moment where a group of writers and artists and architects began to congeal. You know, you have these that will always be associated with the Academy. You know, Jeff Eugenides, Tacita Dean, Thomas de Monde, the architect Regina Leibinger. That began almost our tradition of novelists. We've had wonderful novelists. The poets, whether Augie Kleinzahler or Rosanna Warren, to live with that brilliance in a deployment of language had me running to the library and the bookstores and reading poetry again and fiction. It was the same, you know, with Susanna Moore and with Ha Jin, because Ha Jin is a brilliant master of cultural splicing linguistically. Someone like Larry Lessig is so unique, both in the fact that he's changing things in the world, creative copyright, but also other things, and the absolute rigor he gives to presentation. Everybody should go on the web and watch Larry Lessig give a talk. The journalists, well, George Packer and Laura Secor, Kate Boo. Kate's presentations about her work, immersing herself in communities, whether Mumbai or in the South. I'll never forget Justice Scalia going into the library with the best constitutional minds of Germany, young constitutional law professors, all experts in the United States, and 3 hours later, after a three-hour intellectual slugfest, coming out, and one professor said to the other, I guess I'm going to have to use his book in my courses now. And Scalia also, deep respect after that. I think if you have an institution like this abroad, you have a moral responsibility to create this kind of access. The amazing thing is that the Americans who have these 4, 5, or 9 months, this precious time to work on projects, they've all been willing to play this role of the intellectual ambassador.
The director of the American Academy in Berlin, Gary Smith. And with him, we heard Pamela Rosenberg, the Academy's Dean of Fellows and Programs. Now, with that background, it's time to meet some of the fellows, starting with journalist Anne Hull. You may already be familiar with the name. As a reporter for The Washington Post, she's covered race and class in America, the aftermath of 9/11, the war in Iraq, and the catastrophe of Hurricane Katrina's devastation of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. In 2008, she and her colleague Dana Priest won the Pulitzer Prize for their series of stories on the shocking maltreatment of wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Army Hospital. Here she is on NPR's Talk of the Nation, right after the stories were published in 2007.
Another common refrain was, once a soldier is injured, he or she becomes a second-class citizen in the eyes of the Army. They've lost some importance, and they feel they are neglected once they make that transition from soldier to patient.
Anne Hull has been a Nieman Fellow at Harvard and has taught at Princeton and UC Berkeley. This autumn, she's in Berlin as a Fellow of the American Academy, and she's working on something quite different. A memoir of her childhood in Central Florida's citrus groves in the late 60s and early 70s.
I was born in 1961. There were no black babies allowed to be born in my wing of the hospital. So it was very stark racial divisions, very much the South in some ways. But at the same time, it was a place of incredible beauty. When the orange blossoms were in bloom, it was like a truck had crashed into a perfume counter. It was something out of a dream.
It can be a difficult transition from daily and feature reporting to memoir writing. And Anne Hull is dealing with the challenge on a daily basis. Ines Pohl, the managing editor of Tageszeitung, one of Berlin's major daily newspapers, is an old friend of Anne's. And Anne invited Ines out to the Academy in Wannsee for a visit. We asked them to take a few minutes to talk about Anne's Florida project for Berlin Journal.
And we're sitting here in this beautiful library in the beautiful building of the American Academy facing the Wannsee. It's freezing cold outside, raining, gray and dark. Snow is expected. How is it writing about Florida?
At times I wonder what it would be like to work in Florida in a little Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings Cross Creek type cracker house surrounded by the woods or the orange groves. But there's something to be said about working so far away from where your mind is kind of dwelling.
So you're used to work as a reporter. That's a total different approach to writing, I assume. Could you talk a little bit about the difference?
I think the leap from journalism to memoir has been the most difficult. As a journalist, I watch other people, and this experience has made me completely turn around the telescope and point it inward. I don't wish to write a memoir that's about myself. I wish to write about Florida and what happened on this landscape. In some ways, it's equally about a geography that vanished, and it vanished for all sorts of reasons, from the death of agriculture to development to Walt Disney World. But I never saw it as a story strictly about me. It was about a family's vanishing place on this geography.
But you put yourself in the center of this book.
Yes, I must be the central character. It's a young girl who is in 1967 Florida through 1974 Florida, roughly. And it's me perceiving all sorts of transformation going on, whether it's the orange groves that my father worked in disappearing, my father's personal struggles, his bad weather, as I like to think of it, and the transformation of Florida and what that sense of disappearance does to a kid and does to her identity and her perception of the world.
Do you read a lot? Do you talk to people? Do you go through family letters, pictures?
Reporting has been a difficult quandary in some ways. Here's one small example, which I think a fiction writer would not struggle with. But for example, I thought I lived in a particular house up to a particular year. I went to that county and pulled the property records, the deed to that house, and I was mistaken by 1 year. Mm-hmm. This would be normal in journalism. That's why we do public records checks. But to think that you know your own story and then be surprised by your own mistake is a little bit rattling. And so it makes you then question, what else have I got wrong? And you can really get hung up on facts because, my gosh, that's what we do as journalists. So I've had to sort of push away a little bit and give myself some permission to make some mistakes in memory and tell myself all the time that that's what a memoir is about. It's your memory and the imagination of memory.
So do you allow yourself making mistakes, maybe?
I'm sure there will be mistakes. I'm sure I'm making mistakes constantly, and I'm maybe even making them about emotional observations and not just factual observations. I try to take myself back to 1967 Florida as a kid and looking at the world with those perceptions. And those perceptions are limited. They're not the perceptions of a 49-year-old writer.
Mm. How far does this book go? Does it also go into the present? Like, it's what happens in Florida right now is so interesting. Do you leap so far, or?
I don't see leaping into the contemporary times in Florida. You know, this is a work in progress, and the emphasis right now is on work and not progress. So I'm still trying to figure all that out, and every day I come to sort of different conclusions.
I mean, all Americans probably know very many things about Florida. For us Germans, it's really a dreamland. Maybe it's true for Americans as well. If you would meet someone who does not know anything about Florida, how would you describe it?
Florida is like three different states. There's the North Florida, which is more like the traditional Deep South, like Dixie. And there's Middle Florida, which is where I'm from. And that, in the 60s, was nothing but citrus. I mean, there was more oranges grown in Central Florida than anywhere else in the entire world up through the mid-1970s. And then South Florida is its own sort of different stew. It is Latin America, Central America, South America, Jewish, Italian. It's a piece of Brooklyn in some way. So it's a completely different world there. And I'm primarily focusing on this very rural, untouched interior part of Florida, which was really about orange groves. And because it still is in the South, and it's important to remember that Florida was a Confederate state, Florida was a slave-holding state, and that was very evident in my childhood. The racial divisions were very sharp in Florida. I was born in 1961. There were no black babies allowed to be born in my wing of the hospital. There was a separate wing called the George Carver wing in the hospital where I was born. So it was very stark racial divisions, very much the South in some ways. But at the same time, it was a place of incredible beauty. When the orange blossoms were in bloom in February, it was like a truck had crashed into a perfume counter. It was something out of a dream. And my father worked in citrus, and we had a fruit stand on the highway. So all these tourists, we call them Yankees or snowbirds, would stop at this fruit stand and buy fruit. And that was really my intersection with that larger world outside of this small rural area.
Is there anything left from this kind of Florida?
There are citrus groves in Florida. This part of Florida is known as the Ridge, and it's called that because the land is slightly elevated, and it's very sandy, and it was just perfect for growing oranges. Now there are still some oranges there, but really Brazil and California have taken over the citrus industry. In my hometown, it's been converted to strawberries. And my family still has orange groves. Some were killed in freezes. Some were killed by something called citrus canker. But we do still have some left. But largely, it's a place of strawberries right now.
You stressed it. It's like work. You said it's a lot of work. Why is one writing a biography? Shall we understand Florida better after we read your book?
The question of memoir is entirely different, I've noticed, here in Berlin. People want to know why a memoir. The genre is not quite as common here. And in the United States, everyone and anyone is writing memoir. The reason that motivates me is to write about this place that no longer exists or is on the cusp of extinction. It's essentially a book about extinction, about something that's going away. And I feel like it needs to be captured, it needs to be preserved, and maybe that's where the journalist is at work here, to document something that won't be there probably in 20 years. I want the reader to be taken and transported to another world, first and foremost. I want them to see, to feel, to touch, to smell this world that was there 30, 40 years ago, but is no longer there. And I also want people to think about geography and the environment and what is joy. When I was a kid, Disney World was just opening. And when Disney World opened, it rearranged a child's perceptions of joy. And so I want us to think about the natural paradise versus this artificial paradise. And I want people to think about, what is escape? Is escape a beautiful spring in Florida, or is it Cinderella's castle, man-made, in Orlando, Florida?
Journalist and American Academy fellow Ann Hull, speaking with Ines Pohl, the editor of Berlin's daily Tageszeitung. After the break, we'll discover Franz Kafka's other life and hear about Germany's controversial coming to terms with its future as an immigration nation. You're listening to Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin and the American Academy in Berlin.
Pianist Keith Jarrett offers this advice on how to be a better listener.
Breathe.
Take time, in other words.
Yeah. Turn things off, and then take some time, and then listen.
Sundays have a different pace. We try to reflect that and make time for great music, conversation, and thoughtful perspective on the week's events. Every Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Sunday afternoon at 2 on NPR Berlin 104.1.
We're back again with Berlin Journal, hearing about the life and work of some of the fellows resident at the American Academy this fall. Most of us at one time or another have used the term Kafkaesque to describe a situation we've encountered. When we do, we're describing something grim that has happened, that seems to have no logical explanation and no discernible means of resolution. The term originates in the fertile imagination of the fiction writer Franz Kafka, the author of The Metamorphosis, The Castle, and many other tales of the strange and inexplicable. Kafka is considered by many to be among the finest writers in Western literature and the first great writer of the current industrial age.
What I'm saying is that his work, in a subtle way, often at first invisible, incorporates almost the totality of that new experience of industrial modernity.
In his decades of research and teaching at Princeton, Stanley Korngold has come to live on intimate terms with both the life of Franz Kafka, the writer, and Kafka's little-known other life, that of an influential insurance lawyer. His most recent work, in collaboration with German professor Benno Wagner, has been a close examination of the relationship between Kafka's day job in risk insurance and themes and ideas in his literary work. In the library of the American Academy, Stanley Korngold recently sat down for a conversation with another of this term's fellows, the American novelist John Ray. And quite naturally, John asked first about how Stanley Korngold came to his interest in Kafka.
There's a story here that turned on my brother's rheumatic fever. As a teenager, he was put to bed for a year. There was no penicillin at that time. And his high school teacher took an interest in him and brought books into our house, books we hadn't seen before. They were science books. My brother got to be very good at science. And this teacher told my father that my brother was not going to go to Brooklyn College, which was in the cards, but that he was Columbia University material. Mm-hmm. So Noel went off to Columbia, brought back the great books, and thought it might be a good thing for me to enrich the Lafayette High School reading list with a copy of Kafka's Metamorphosis. That is a gripping story. Of course, I mean the Metamorphosis. And as it happened, some years later, at Princeton, Metamorphosis was on the reading list of a great books course for which I was precepting. So I was reacquainted with Metamorphosis, and by a happy chance, a friend editing new translations of world classics suggested I might try my hand at translating Metamorphosis. And once involved with Kafka's style and his language, I was really quite entranced. It's a very special German. You don't see it elsewhere, especially in the works of writers contemporaneous with Kafka in Prague. That clarity, that magic is found nowhere else. Once you're entranced by his magic and his clarity, it's hard to let him go. He accommodates an immense amount of the cultural life of modern industrial Europe, because it's little known that Prague and Bohemia was called the Manchester of Central Europe. It was a place in which you could get in touch with all the currents that make up industrial modernity. Rapidity of communication, refinements of machinery, and also complex systems of social security, of workmen's compensation, which happened to be the field in which Kafka was professionally active. What I'm saying is that his work, in a subtle way, often at first invisible, incorporates almost the totality of that new experience of industrial modernity.
Kafka was really ideally situated in a certain sense, not only in terms of when he was born, but where he was born, and also in terms of the profession that he eventually chose to be a modern writer, a writer of the sort of modern experience
yes.
that was just taking form at the time that he came of age.
As a specialist in workmen's accidents, he dwelt on notions of risk. Of course, risk and damage. And it's instructive to think about the content of his work in light of those two categories. For example, his heroes are persons who suffer accidents for which, ironically, there is no compensation conceivable, no insurance in principle, for persons who wake up one morning to discover that they have been metamorphosed into monstrous sort of vermin, or a person who wakes up in the morning to discover two wardens of a court charging him with an offense but never specifying its content. It's hard to get insurance for these predicaments. Kafka's view of the world, it can be said, both in his life and in his fiction, was to view all objects and all persons as potentially risky, capable of causing damage. And that might be one of the motives for his sought after solitude. The solitude, of course, which enabled him to write, but a solitude which was also a sort of preference. So aware was he of the risks that especially a technologically addicted society now posed to the individual.
It's an interesting sort of irony then that Kafka's quest for solitude as essentially as a way to sort of create some sort of shelter from the world of risk. I mean, he seems to have understood the world primarily in terms of risk, should eventually prove useless in that the risk sort of proceeded from his own body eventually in the course of his illness.
Yes. He suffered from ill health, which was a great pity because as a young man he was athletic, he thought continually about the body as a philosopher of the body. Think of the attention to the body of that transformed traveling salesman in the story Metamorphosis. Many diary entries talk about his unusual relation to his body, which he thought, of course, was too long and too slight to sustain him. In fact, observers would comment on the very great elegance of Kafka's physical being. He was a clothes horse. He wore beautiful clothes. All the photographs of him show him to be a very handsome man. He was afflicted with a tuberculosis. Unfortunately, his illness was much aggravated by that dreadful flu epidemic that burst in on Europe toward the end of the First World War and caused untold millions of deaths throughout the world.
Yeah, he was very active in trying to improve his health. He didn't receive it passively, as certain characters in Kafka's fiction might have done, but in fact struggled against it very heroically.
That's a very suggestive remark. His concern for the body extends to his great and little-known concern for veterans of the First World War, and above all, those who suffered from traumatic shock and whose symptoms ran right through their bodies. There's a piece that Kafka wrote for a newspaper which describes the sight of war veterans trembling on the streets of Prague. It's a very dramatic opening to an article which seeks to get money and influence for founding the first sanatorium we know of, certainly in Bohemia, for persons suffering from shell shock. The First World War was, in a very material sense, a kind of huge industrial accident. Normally, workmen's accidents were byproducts of the manufacture of goods. In this instance, the manufacturer aimed at was accidents, mutilations of persons. Kafka's office, which was concerned with providing insurance and retribution for workmen who suffered industrial accidents, was now responsible for the care of veterans coming back from the front, which shows you how he is at the cusp of modern thinking.
Mm-hmm. Now, a great deal has been written and said over the years about office life and the bureaucratic life as an oppressive force in Kafka's life. But I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the office as a source of inspiration to Kafka. You have a wonderful quote in one article that I read from Kafka in which he says, "The office is a human being watching me with innocent eyes wherever I am, a living person to to whom I have become attached in some way unknown to me.
Yes, it's a very unusual quote and helps to dispel the common view, which is not without its merits, that Kafka also hated the office. His relation to the office was ambivalent. Writing at the office desk was not what he wanted to do the most in the world. He wanted to write at his fiction writer's desk. On the other hand, willy-nilly, what he wrote in the office begins to penetrate his fictional work, both at the level of quite particular images, at the level of schemes of logic, ways of thinking. For example, the great novel of Kafka's, the last novel, called The Castle, is about the attempts of a pretend land surveyor to be admitted to a community.
Well, an
imposter. He is probably an imposter. It's very hard to figure out whether he was properly ever summoned by the castle or whether he is pretending to have been summoned by the castle. There's a good deal of evidence for both sides of the matter. But where on earth does the pretend land surveyor come in? Well, as it happens, some decade before Kafka was writing The Castle, he was concerned with the interesting problem of insuring farm workers against accident in their work on farms. Now, this is a very tricky requirement. It's hard to think through what an appropriate premium would be, because workmen in factories come and go. Farmers don't like to keep accurate records of the accidents that occur. It might be that farm hands are mutilated and move on. Kafka finally decided there was no way to get to a proper premium except through a flat tax on acreage, which of course required good data about acreage, which required, of course, very responsible land surveyors. Mm-hmm. Well, we have his correspondence pointing out that there is an utter dearth of responsible land surveyors. Those who prop up are all pretend land surveyors. We can get nowhere in this project. I think this occurs to him beginning as he begins to write The Castle.
One doesn't feel, reading even the most dreamlike of Kafka's texts, that the author is simply following his fancy wherever it might lead him in the sense of someone daydreaming. One always feels that very pressing and weighty and relevant matters are being discussed in a way that is strange and new.
Yes. It makes me think of one piece of the real world that enters his novels in a way that isn't often noticed. If you stop to think about the heroes of the three great novels, there's nothing heroic about them at all. Mm-hmm. They are normal. Where does this concept of the normal character come from? Of course, from Kafka's insurance reflections. All insurance thought rests on the basis of norming accidents in quantity and quality. If you study Kafka's accident reports, you notice that the category called details of the accident begins to disappear. It doesn't matter anymore. We know what quantity of accidents is going to occur in any given year, in any given branch of industry. Details of the injury, not really very relevant.
Well, Stanley, thank you very much. I've learned quite a lot today.
Two of this semester's fellows at the American Academy, Stanley Korngold, Professor Emeritus of German Literature at Princeton, and the American novelist John Ray. Professor Korngold currently co-directs the Princeton Kafka Network with Oxford University and Humboldt University, and is co-editing a collection of essays entitled Kafka for the 21st Century. John Ray's most recent novel, Low Boy, is now available in paperback. We have time to meet one more fellow in this edition of Berlin Journal.
I'm Tamar Jacoby. I'm the president of Immigration Works USA, and I'm a fellow here, I'm the Bosch fellow here this fall at the American Academy in Berlin. I help small business owners who hire immigrants, both dairy farms and nursery owners and restaurants and IT mom and pop shops, startups, who want to be on the right side of the law. I help them make their voices heard in the immigration debate in the U.S. Because my argument is that the U.S. and other countries need immigration laws that are consistent with their labor needs.
It turns out that this fall has been a very opportune time for Tamar Jacoby's visit. A new book titled Germany Does Away With Itself by a major public figure, Thilo Sarrazin, has caused a political firestorm. In it, he argues that Germany's Muslim immigrants are inferior in every way, including intellectually, to everyone else in the country. The ensuing debate has brought out both defenders and detractors of this former German central bank official, and it has focused attention on the very real issues of Germany's changing role as an immigration nation. For Tamar Jacoby, the timing couldn't be better to study the changing face of the German population and ponder what the nation might look like in the future.
I wanted to come to Germany to look at how Germany's handling immigration, because I think in the shrinking globalized world, all of the developed countries are, whether they want to or not, going to be countries of immigration. And so with the United States and Germany and others are facing the question of, if we're going to have immigrant workers come and they're going to be good, basically in the end good for our economies, how are they going to fit into our societies? And how are we going to remain nations that are comfortable being nations but yet have some room for difference? And I think the United States is struggling with it, but Germany's also struggling with it.
Give us a little perspective about Germany as a nation with immigrants.
Foreign workers have been coming to Germany since the 1960s, since the late 50s, in fact. Initially, they came to help rebuild the country after the destruction of World War II. Those workers came through the 60s and into the 70s, and then most of those less skilled workers stopped. They came from Turkey and Yugoslavia and Italy and other countries. And now more recently, Germany, like all the other countries in the world, has been eager to attract high-skilled workers, the workers who are now the most sought-after economic resource in the world, scientists, engineers, innovators. So Germany has a lot of unskilled people of what they call migration background, and now they're working to attract skilled people of migration background. In the 60s and 70s, the people who came were guest workers. They were meant to go home. Germany made no plans or gave no thought to how to help them settle and integrate. But it turned out many of them did not go home. They brought wives. They had children. They live here. And only 10 years ago, a generation after the people arrived, did Germany start to say, well, gee, these people live here. How are we going to help them integrate? So no one had even given any thought to integrating them until about 10 years ago. And in that 10 years, they've been giving a lot of thought to it, but it's an ongoing conversation.
What kinds of help does Germany give to immigrants?
Germany has and like most European countries, like Canada, unlike the United States, Germany has an extensive network of language programs, civic courses, how to get along with the people in your neighborhood courses. Every town, every neighborhood, every state, the federal government, extensive web of programs that are essentially remedial programs to help people catch up, something that we don't do very much in the United States. Sometimes when I compare Germany and the United States, I say it's like two people trying to sing a song, one of which knows the words but can't really find the tune, and the other one, which has the tune, can sing the tune but doesn't know the words. And Germany knows the words in the sense that they are providing this extensive web of courses, but they're only finding their way toward something that the United States has been doing for a long time, is conceiving of itself as a country that accepts immigrants, that understands difference, that can accommodate difference within a sense of national identity that coheres. That's a delicate balance, having a robust, vigorous, working national identity, and yet being able to accept people who are different within that. It's a balance I think the United States doesn't always get right, but occasionally we get it right. We at least have a vision of it. Germany, I think, hardly even knows the balance that they're trying to strike yet. And they're that's what the debate is about. They're struggling with what that would mean.
We were all brought up to think the U.S. is a nation of immigrants. And we learn the story of every successive immigration group. And you learn that the ultimate goal is this nation of nations. They're all Americans, and they all preserve whatever parts of their heritage and their religious practice, social customs, whatever they want. What would they see as the German equivalent?
Yeah, I think that's the point. They don't quite yet. I think they cover over a lot of their past history. They think of their nation as very homogeneous, defined by a culture. For years, citizenship was defined by blood. You couldn't be a German citizen unless your parents were German citizens. They didn't have a sense of themselves as a melting pot. But in fact, for many generations, they have been a kind of a magna country in the middle of Europe. Jews came in the 19th century, in the early 20th century. Other Europeans came. French-speaking people came from the other side. Poles came. Huguenots came. Again, they're smack in the middle of Europe. People have been crossing and staying for a long time. So there has been more mixture than they think of, but they don't have an image of it or an ideal for it. And again, that's what they're working toward, is can there be a notion of what it means to be German that leaves some room for difference?
Now, you come to Berlin, to the Academy, with your project, and what happens?
Well, my timing couldn't have been better. As I was packing my suitcases, practically, a man who was a former member of the board of the Central Bank, a lifetime political establishment figure in Germany, wrote a best-selling book, it sold about 1 million copies already, saying that this Turkish population is dumbing down the nation, that Germany is essentially doing itself in by having immigrants, that people of Turkish background are inherently less intelligent than Germans, and needless to say, stirring up a hornet's nest of debate. To make it even more complicated, he was a member of the SPD, the major left-of-center party. Various political players have scrambled since the book came out to position themselves, with the chancellor making a major speech saying that multiculturalism has failed in Germany and stirring up a second hornet's nest.
How would an American understand multiculturalism?
The conventional understanding of these matters is that the choice is between something like multiculturalism, which means great respect to the point of deference to diversity, or no difference. People use the word assimilation or melting pot, forcibly homogeneous society. And I think when the chancellor said multiculti is dead, a lot of people thought she was saying Germany should go from all difference all the time to no difference at all. I think the choice now for Germany is not do they go from all difference all the time, which they never had or never were going to have, to no difference at all, which I don't think is a choice either. She has tried to clarify it. Others have talked about it. She has been, in all fairness, for a long time, somebody who did try to advance an integrationist agenda and encourage these programs and get funding for these programs and put light on the issue. She's also facing a situation where her party is worried about losing people on the right, and the Sarrazin book, the central banker's book, is very popular, and I think there's some political positioning going on here as well.
Can you overlay for us the demographics in Germany?
There are 82 million people. I believe there are 15 million people of what they call migration background, which means immigrants, immigrants' children, and in some cases, immigrants' grandchildren. I think about 3 to 4 million of them are of Turkish descent. German women are now having, the demographic number is 1.38 babies each. Replacement level is 2.1 babies per family, per couple. In the United States, we're having about 2 babies per couple. 1.38 is a bad situation. If they go on at that level, by 2050, they'll literally be tens of millions of people smaller as a country. Turks have big families. People who've lived here a long time send back to Turkey and find wives in Turkey and bring the wives here, often people who don't speak the language at all, who aren't comfortable at all in the society, from very poor, backward.
So a child in a Turkish home in Germany is not getting the kind of support at home, sometimes not getting the support to help them with their schoolwork.
Absolutely not. again, we're talking about often parents who don't speak the language at all, often people who come from rural areas and deep poverty in Turkey and have no education, thrown into a very competitive school system where, in fact, students are tracked at age 10 and their futures are determined. And this is one of the big problems. The brightest of young Turkish background kids is not going to catch up by, you know, it's hard to catch up by age 10 if you ever catch up. And if your future is already determined at age 10 or even 12 as they're thinking of changing it, very hard to make the system work for you to get to the top.
So now we have the political scene, and you've told us about the demographics. So now you're in Germany, you're in Berlin and in Dresden, and what are people saying to you, and what are they asking you about? What questions do they have for you?
I think the Saracen book did something useful in the sense that it ripped the veil off the issue. This is an issue that they know exists, but that lots of people did not give much thought to. Elites started thinking about it hard about 10 years ago, but a lot of the public did not think too much about it. Ripping off that veil, in some ways, created space for people to give voice to some not very nice sentiments. But I think for a lot of other people, it made them ask themselves, what's the problem and what should we as a country be doing about it? I would say that there's more a kind of an openness to talk about the subject of, gee, we've got a problem, what do we do? And we have to put a little parenthesis here, right? Germany is a country that, for obvious reasons of 20th century history, is a little uncomfortable asserting a vigorous, robust national identity. It's been uncomfortable with that for many decades. Some young people now are saying we need a more robust national identity, but the delicate dance of having a robust national identity that's robust enough that you can allow difference, it's quite a few steps from where many people start.
Tamar Jacoby, president of Immigration Works USA and a former writer and editor for the New York Times and Newsweek. She's the author most recently of The New Immigrants and What It Means to Be an American from Basic Books. And that's it for this edition of Berlin Journal. Our program is a production of the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin. For more information on the Academy and video features on our fellows, visit americanacademy.de. And for more on the station and its programming, please visit nprberlin.de. We had production help from Malte Mau and Peter Solomon in Berlin and Sarah Richards in Washington. Our regular host, R.J. McGill, will be back for the next edition. Until then, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Thanks for being with us.